read that you had a guidance counseling exercise that suggested you would make a good drill sergeant.
I know, and that one, that was a real surprise.
What was it that, what happened there?
So they had, back in that time, I don't know if you remember, they had this thing called the Career Mobile, right? And it would be like this van that would show up outside of a high school, and you'd go in and they would have pre-selected tests that you could take to kind of figure out what occupations would be suitable for you.
And I remember you came up with drill sergeant.
I would say whatever algorithm. So whether that was whether that it saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, or it was the fault of the algorithm, I don't know. But it came up drill sergeant, and I thought, oh my god, that was not on my radar at all.
From Lab Occupier, this is NGB Ideas, a podcast about the personal journey of leaders, innovators, and disruptors in Canada's life sciences community. Hi. I'm your host, Jim Wilson, and our guest today is Tamara Seals, who is president of Seaford Pharmaceuticals, a proudly Canadian-made and family-owned business. Before we get to our conversation with Tamara, I would like to take a moment to thank the Hamilton Health Sciences Foundation, the TMX Group, and Ellis Dawn for their support. This episode of NGB Ideas was recorded in March 2024. Tamara, welcome to NGB Ideas. It's great to have you.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
I read that you were born in Toronto, but your parents are originally from the Caribbean. Where were they born?
So my mother was born in Jamaica and my father was born in Grenada.
I read, unfortunately, that your mother passed away 15 years ago from cancer. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Could you tell us about her?
Sure. I mean, she was an amazing individual. She is someone that people would meet and not forget. So she grew up very kind of middle class Jamaican, and she had she was in a family of five, and her father passed away very, very early. I think she was about 7 years old when her father passed away. But she had her mom and her grandmother, and it was a very, very close knit family that she grew up in. And in the area of Jamaica that she came from, which was Kingston, kind of like a suburban area of their major city, she had a real support system around, because back then, I mean, she was born in 1940. So back then there wasn't a whole lot of insurance or support when the main breadwinner of the family had passed away. But she was able to rely on family support to get by. And she was someone who was extremely industrious. She had a career in banking. She worked in banking in Jamaica. And then she was actually the one who had decided to emigrate. And at that time, my parents had three kids, of which I wasn't born yet. I wasn't thought of. They would tell me quite often. And so mid-70s, they emigrated to Canada. And that was a huge culture shift, right?
I bet.
Especially coming from, say, like middle upper class, where they had a gardener and a housekeeper and someone to pump their gas. And, you know, moving to Canada, where none of that was the case for them, right? They really started over. And as was the case for many, many people who did, you know, similar kind of migrations, there really was that culture shift. And I think what made it even more interesting, perhaps, is an adjective that I'll choose to use, was within about 12 months or so of them arriving, they learned that a fourth child was on the way, which was me. So it's interesting, because when my mom would tell the story, she said, oh, it was a lovely surprise. But other family members would say, well, think about it, right? You're in your mid to late 30s. You have three kids. You've just emigrated. You're starting life all over again. And then you find out that another one's on the way. So surprise, yes. Pleasant. I don't know if that exactly would have been characterized as a pleasant surprise. But my parents, my mom was extremely industrious. She worked many different jobs. She continued banking while she was in Canada, but she ended up being a real entrepreneur of sorts. So she was really interested in fashion and things of the aesthetic. And we had spent some time in Alberta when my father got transferred out that way. And She opened up a dress shop in a mall out there, which again was kind of, that was just part of her entrepreneurial way. And we then came back after some time in Alberta, back to Toronto, and she opened an art gallery. And so she had that for many years before retiring. So she was always someone who was interested in pursuing different interests.
I suspect I'm picking up on where you get part of your drive.
You know, I think it was both. It was both of them, but certainly she wasn't afraid to try new and different things, as many people, you know, of her generation had to do, just to kind of figure things out, to put food on the table, but also to express her creativity and her ingenuity at the same time.
Wow. Your father, Ron, he's still with us, correct?
That's right. He's very much,
and
very much.
Growing concern. Could you tell us about him? Like, what do you remember about him as a father growing up?
Yeah. So he was born in Grenada, which is a very tiny island, just kind of off the coast of Trinidad. But he left home when he was 18 and never really looked back. So he joined the army and was living in Jamaica, where he met my mom and spent another just about 18 years. And then, of course, with my mom, emigrated to Toronto. But he had a career that started in Jamaica in pharmaceuticals. So he worked for Glaxo back then. And okay. He went to England for his formal training. And then when he came to Canada, he had a long career in pharmaceutical, primarily in sales and marketing, and then worked his way up to become general manager of a number of international firms. And so he had spent a lot of time traveling. So he definitely had his boots on the ground, coast to coast, you know, in Canada. And that's what prompted the relocation from Toronto to Edmonton.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Where we spent 7 years. And then he had a job opportunity back here in Toronto. And that's why we came back. And then he reached a point in his career, I either had to make a choice of continuing to work for large pharma, or he dared to be different. Maybe it was my mom's influence, where he decided to go off on his own and start his own organization. And so that's something that's not very typical.
So you spent your formative years in the West End. Where did you grow up specifically?
Yeah, in Brampton. So okay. My dad worked for a company called Roan Palenque, Roar, and they were based out of Bramalea at the time. So that's why he moved to Brampton.
Huh. What was your household like when you were growing up? Was it pretty liberal, pretty conservative, you know, carefree?
No, I would not say carefree. That's I would say pretty conservative, right? My dad was very, I guess, like a traditional kind of alpha male sort of Caribbean man, but very safe, very loving, community oriented. We had not a lot of family around, because again, everybody was sort of spread out, but in terms of being close to the church, being close to community friends, that was definitely a part of it. Our house was a bit like Grand Central Station. The door was never really locked, right? So we always had friends over, and I guess, you know, kind of typical in the 80s, where it was like, you know, play outside and come home when the street lights come on, kind of a thing, right? So safe neighborhood, kind of, I don't know if I would say uninteresting, but uneventful, right? Like nothing that was too crazy. I mean, my dad, he did travel a lot for work. So he often, you know, wasn't home, but we had the typical dog and a bird. And, you know, I walked to school with my friends. So yeah, it was kind of low key.
Oh, cool. So did your family make a point of keeping its ties to family and friends in the Caribbean?
Certainly, because my mother's mom still lived in Jamaica. And so up until her passing, my mom, as often as she could, would go back. And that was always something that was important to us. There is an event called Caravana that happens every summer in Toronto, which is a huge Caribbean
festival. I've heard of it. Yeah.
And so my parents would make a point of, we wouldn't necessarily participate in the parade itself, but we would go and watch and, you know, enjoy the festivities. And so that was always a part. So it was, And in some ways, which I think is interesting, primarily because I had mentioned how my siblings had their adolescence out west. I didn't. So my adolescence was, you know, like I said, like in the West End, which was much more multicultural. And because of that, I was able to connect with other kids of similar heritage. So in some ways, I ended up emulating kind of a Caribbean, more things Caribbean than my siblings would have. So in terms of the music I listened to, the styles, you know, maybe the way that I talk, sometimes I would come home with a Jamaican accent. My mom would say, where is this even coming from? How can you have a Jamaican accent? And you weren't even born there. Right. So, but that was just a function of how multicultural it was where I was growing up in my neighborhood and in the school that I went to.
Looking back, how much of an impact do you think heritage has played in your life and your family?
Oh, that's a good question, Jim. I mean, I think especially being Canadian, it's mixed, right? Because there is that mixed identity, which makes it so much more interesting, makes it kind of fun. But there is that Jamaican component and that Eastern Caribbean where my father was from, but also very much Canadian as well, right? So it's we ate Canadian food at home, but there would be a blend, right? There would be the jerk chicken and the rice and peas, but there would also be, you know, the macaroni and cheese and all the other stuff that was just very typically Canadian. So I would say that it really was a blend, as it is for many, many people. And kind of having that ability to parlay or transition kind of in and out of whether that might be like a Caribbean mindset versus what one might consider kind of a Canadian mindset. And I think over time, they've all just kind of intermingled, if you will.
Do you remember what dreams you had growing up as a kid?
It certainly was not to become the president of a pharmaceutical company.
Like you were 10 and you weren't thinking this is on my radar.
No. I mean, I think I dreamt of, I used to really want to be a newscaster. I always loved to kind of talk, right? And kind of share I thought that being a newscaster, I'd be able to share my thoughts, but that's not really what you do if you're like a journalist necessarily or a newscaster. But I never really grew up with something specific. Like some people, they wake up and they know, or they grow up and they know they want to be like a doctor or a pilot or something. That wasn't me. I was a pretty decent student. I love to study. I love academia. I wasn't anchored to anything specific.
I read that you had a guidance counseling exercise that suggested you would make a good drill sergeant.
I know, and that was a real surprise.
What happened there?
So they had, back in that time, I don't know if you remember, they had this thing called the Career Mobile, right? And it would be like this van that would show up outside of a high school, and you go in and they would have pre-selected tests that you could take to kind of figure out what occupations would be suitable for you. And I remember,
and you came up with drill sergeant.
I would say whatever algorithm. So whether it saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, or it was the fault of the algorithm, I don't know. But it came up drill sergeant, and I thought, oh my god, that was not on my radar at all.
Did I got to ask? Did your parents go, yeah, that makes sense?
You know what? They actually said that they saw something in that I didn't see, and I thought, oh my god. I didn't think I was like that.
Was there anything else any other suggestions that came up? Or it was like, okay.
It was, was the thing that stood out, where it was significantly higher than anything else was, you know, drill sergeant. And I don't know if that was foreshadowing because, you know, fast forward, my husband, turns out that he had spent a number of years in the military and he himself was a drill sergeant. So I don't know if that was some foreshadowing at that time that I could never have figured out.
Hi, it's Jim. We hope you're enjoying our conversation with Tamara Seals and would like to remind our listeners this podcast is part of Next Great Big Ideas, Canada's Life Sciences Summit. NGBI 2024 is taking place this year at the Hamilton Convention Center on November 12th. And if you are a member of the Canadian Life Sciences community, we invite you to join us. For details, please go to nextgreatbigideas.com. So you finished high school in, what, I guess, 96, 97? In 97, you enrolled at York University in Toronto to study business administration. And Tamara, why York and why business?
First, about why business is because I was really interested, Jim, in pursuing a course of study that I felt I could translate it into a job right away, as opposed to taking something where it might be a little bit harder to do that, right? Like history or geography or something like that. So I was really focused on trying to be as practical as possible. That was kind of my thing. And I also wanted to minimize costs because I was paying for university myself. So I chose to stay at home and to attend a university that I could from home. So that basically left, I guess I could have gone to Mac, but it was U of T or York. So I had applied to a bunch and I got into U of T, but also to York. And I just thought, because I didn't really want to go downtown and I liked the business program there. So that's why I decided on York.
Huh. And you mentioned you put yourself through school. Where did you work?
I worked for a beer distribution company called Premier Brands that was based initially in Mississauga, and they then moved to Oakville. So, what was also good about going to York is I registered in their evening program. So I would work during the day. So I would drive from, and at that time we had moved from Brampton to Caledon. So I would commute from Caledon to Oakville and work where I was an office administrator during the day. And then I think the first class in at York would start at 4 o'clock. So they had like a 4 to 7 and then 7 to 10 series of classes. And so I would drive from Oakville over to York and do my classes in the evening.
Wow, so you were spending as much time in the car as you were in class and at the job.
Well, you know what, Jim, traffic wasn't as bad then as it is now. Okay. Nowadays, different story. Yeah.
Now, I read that at one point your GPA was too low for you to graduate and you had to learn some hard lessons.
Yes, exactly. So I was really focusing a lot on work and I really didn't spend a whole lot of time socializing at school. And also, because I had been a fairly strong student in high school, I just had applied sort of the same study habits that I had in high school to when I went to university. And there was a point that my GPA fell below an acceptable level. And I had a talk with one of the counselors there, and they were like, you know what, you really need to change your entire approach to what you're doing. And that was a real eye opener for me. And it was a really great way actually to learn a lesson, because that taught me that I couldn't continue doing what I was doing, you know, using the same approach that I had previously. And I had to reprioritize, because ultimately my goal was to graduate from university, and I was jeopardizing everything by kind of focusing too much on my work. So that's where I had to shuffle things around. And I also really focused on just that the rigor that is required at university. It's just another level, right? And not having things come so easily to me, I had to really apply some discipline, really, right? That it wasn't so much about how much I studied. It was about making sure that I got the results. And it was just about a shift in mindset. So that was a real learning for me. And I wouldn't really change that, because I think that set me up for success for future challenges.
You graduated from York University in 2000 with a BA in Business Administrative Studies. And then you disappeared for 3 months. Where'd you go?
I went to Europe. I did that stereotypical backpacking thing, which it was amazing and it changed my life. I loved it. So that was my first time really being away from home. A lot of my friends, they went to away universities and lived on res, which I didn't, right? And so this was an opportunity for me to just kind of explore who I was on my own without being at home. So I think I did maybe about 30 different cities over 3 months and stayed at hostels. Mm-hmm. And again, that was with no cell phones back then. That was before the euro. So yeah, I had to, you know, do foreign exchange, and literally I had a map to map out where we were going to go. back in those days. Yeah. Right.
I remember it. Wow. So you came back after 3 months, and at that point, your father's company was, I guess, about 9 years old. Did he or your mother pull you aside and say, okay, you know, let's have a talk?
Not even. Yeah. I came back, and it was maybe August, September, around that time of 2000. And I had planned to, I was thinking about going to law school. So I was studying for the LSAT. And while I was studying and trying to kind of, you know, sort of figure things out, I said to my dad, hey, what if I come and spend some time at Seaford? And my dad said, yeah, sure. You're always welcome. And so I literally started, I think he had a vacancy in reception. And so I was the receptionist at the front. And after a few weeks, I remember going to my dad and I said, Dad, I have something to tell you. And he said, what? And I said, I'm really surprised. And he said, a surprise about what? And I said, Seaford. And he's like, okay, like what? And he said, Seaford is like a real company. And he said, well, what did you expect? Like, literally, what did you think was happening for the last 9 years? And I think to your point, Jim, you know what you're, I don't know, I was a teenager in my early 20s, just consumed with myself, you know, my studies, my friends, so many other things that I hadn't really stopped to think or process.
And connected the dots.
No.
So, hey, Dad, you've got a bit of a thing here. It's pretty impressive.
No. And it was like a real thing, right? And I found that it was just so interesting and there was so much to learn, right? And so rather than, I don't even know if I ended up writing my LSAT. Maybe I did or didn't, but I got so engaged at things at Seaford. And so I ended up working my way through virtually every department. So I started at reception, then I moved to office admin, and then I did some work in the warehouse in the back, and then in HR, and worked through all of the different functional areas. And what struck me was how fascinating it was learning about the company, but learning about the industry, and realizing how much there was to do, and just and I guess because I had studied business, but sort of seeing part of it in practice, and because I had the opportunity to have access to the different functional areas, that was a great opportunity for me. It was really enthralling.
So you walked in thinking, okay, it's something to pay the bills, and all of a sudden the blinders came off.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there was a conversation you had with your father or he had with you where he said, okay, I think this is where I'm supposed to be.
And it was something, sure, it was definitely something that was gradual, you know, Jim, over time. But it didn't take me long to realize that I wanted to stay at Seaford to make it a career versus it just being a stopgap. Mm-hmm. I had two of my two brothers were also working in the organization at the time. My sister wasn't. She worked at the bank for many, many years. And my dad was always eager to give me more, to kind of push me. So he's very much, as being a self-made person, he would always give me things just above my level. Now that was very much his approach, has always been to kind of give a stretch goal or see what more, you know, I could do. And I found that there was always more that I could do, and it became very engaging and very, very, very interesting for me.
Huh. So he saw your appetite and he kept feeding it. Good for
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So in life sciences entrepreneurship, at least, I think that there's two sides. There's the research side and the business side.
Yeah.
And you obviously have focused on the business side, but did you ever consider the research end of it at all?
Really good question. I did. Because we're selling science, you know, at the end of the day, right? And that's where it would always come back to. But it wasn't a consideration that was enough for me to think, should I go back and do my bachelor's? I had also thought, should I work for another pharmaceutical organization? And that is something that I spent more time thinking about, which was should I work for another pharma company to kind of just understand, rather than having all of my experience at one organization. And so that's much more of a frequent conversation that my dad and I had, right? Where I thought maybe it would be better for me to go out and work for a bit, kind of learn the lay of the land, learn, you know, network and so forth. And interestingly enough, he was just always really happy to have me there. So after a number of years, I think in 2004, I decided rather than going, you know, to pursue something in science or to work for another organization, I decided to pursue my MBA. And so that's what I did.
And it sounds like that was an obvious decision for you.
Yeah, because, and what was also key for me was to go and pursue my MBA and bring back the knowledge to Seaford to see what I could apply. And that was also interesting because when I joined the program, most people were using the program as a way to pivot to another either functional area or to another organization or another level in their career.
You were using it to amplify, weren't you?
Totally, totally. That was my focus.
Okay.
And so that was my perspective with every course that I, whether it was marketing, you know, economics, finance, whatever it was, how can I apply this specifically to Seaford with these product launches or this activity that we want to do? Huh. It was a very different mindset.
So you did your MBA at the Schulich School of Business at York University, and you chose to go on a student exchange. Where did you go?
So that was an interesting choice. And maybe it was from the backpacking that I did in Europe where it was when I did the Europe thing, it was, okay, let me just do something different, go somewhere else. So I thought, let me do something different. Let me go somewhere else. And I chose Johannesburg, South Africa, which at the time also happened to be the murder capital of the world. Right.
I'll bet you that conversation went over well at home.
So that one very much so. I mean, and I think, you know, Schulich was a great program and they had a choice of probably 30 different cities, maybe even more. And I remember my parents saying to me, out of all of these cities, why did you have to choose the murder capital of the world? And so I said to them, I wasn't choosing, it wasn't that I was focusing on the murder component, the murder capital piece. But it was in Africa, it was English speaking. So it was somewhere that was far away and that would have a different culture, but yet because of the language, that wouldn't have been an issue, you know, for me. So I chose Johannesburg.
Wow. Academically, I'm sure that was, and personally must have been an incredible experience, but you also had, an accident when you were there.
That's right. And that's a story that is interesting in that my parents, again, had blamed me for my choice of going there. But I was in Joburg and a bunch of students. We went on a road trip to Durban, which is a coastal city a few hours away. And on the way back, we got into a car accident. And so I ended up in the hospital for a little bit. So nothing that was too crazy, but I had a fractured pelvis. So then I had to recover for a little bit back at the residence. And good thing that I had finished most of my studies so that the classwork and most of that was done. And then I had to go back home. And that was kind of fun, but not fun. I had to lay flat because of the nature of my injuries. So that required a first class ticket on the way back where I could I could lay down. So
not the greatest way to get the ticket, by the way.
right. Do what you got to do. So and that was kind of interesting because I was dating someone who was in my program at Schulich. And I told my dad, look, I have to fly back, but I cannot do it on my own. I have to be accompanied. And so my dad said, okay, no problem. I'll send one of your brothers. And I said, well, actually, Dad, there's somebody else that I would like to accompany me back. And my dad, who is this?
So he was your, so this is now your husband, correct?
That's right.
And what's his name?
Damon. And so this was the first that I think my parents had even heard of this Damon. Who is this Damon? So that was an interesting experience. I think they had the first phone call on the, you know, like on the phone. Because my parents were, you know, it's a cure of mine, literally half the world away, right? I had these injuries, I had crutches, whatever. And then to them, sending like the stranger to go and collect, you know, their daughter, right? But anyway, I vouched for him. I said, you know, he's a good one. So he came and he got me. I think he spent maybe a night or two, like turn around, and then and we flew back. So that would have been 2005, I think. And we ended up getting married in 2007. So he was one of the good ones.
Hi, it's Jim again. Before we get back to our conversation, we'd like to explain what this podcast is all about. We created NGB Ideas to help promote the Next Great Big Ideas Summit, which is a fundraising initiative in support of McMaster Children's Hospital in Hamilton, Ontario. MCH is one of the top critical pediatric care facilities in Canada, and if you are financially able, we hope you will consider supporting this organization. For more information, please go to hamiltonhealthsciences.ca/McMaster-Children's-Hospital. Thanks so much. You came back to Seaford in 2006 and became general manager of the company, a title I think you still hold, in addition to another title that we'll talk about. And you got back to the company with your MBA in hand, and I'm wondering if you know if you had plans to say, okay, like we're going to make some big changes and we're going to take this company public, and what was going through your mind at that
point? Yeah, totally. Like world domination. Like, let's do this now. Let's make it happen. We've been sleeping for the past however many years. I'm going to come with my MBA and we are, you know, TSX, here we come. Like, let's just blow it out. Do everything. It was interesting because my dad never said no. He never said no. He was just like, okay, make a plan. And it was the process of making the plan. I realized, okay, so here are some limiting factors, right? Like, you know, we've already tried this or we've done that, or maybe there are certain principles that we have or certain values as an organization, you know, that we have, which might inform sort of the direction that we're, you know, we're going in. And that was another learning, right? Which is I had all of this theoretical knowledge, which was again interesting because my undergrad was in business, right? So I think having that work experience made me a better student before I did the MBA. So it made me a better student so that I could learn more. But then what ended up happening is I had, say, maybe refreshed theoretical knowledge, right? Coming and as I tried to apply it at Seaford, absolutely there were certain things like establishing processes, looking to create more structure where perhaps things had been a little bit more open-ended. But also it was another learning process, especially in our industry where things are so technical and heavily regulated that things just can't happen overnight, right? And so I learned a lot about how to apply what I knew to a real world setting.
So the ideas and the enthusiasm didn't meet resistance. They kind of met reality.
Precisely. Yeah, okay. Precisely. Yeah.
So your father eventually stepped back and you became president of the company in April 2018, and he remains very much involved as CEO. Was that an easy transition for both of you?
I think not necessarily. It was gradual. And I think the fact that I had been working there for so long, obviously, played a role, but it's just like so many things, Jim. Sometimes when you get what you want, it's a little bit different than what it ends up actually being, right? An incredible amount of responsibility. Also, given the family dynamic. So right. They're my two older brothers by far, right? So older. Having me take on that role was also something that was noteworthy, and that really gave all of us pause. So I wouldn't say that it was entirely smooth, but it was kind of a bumpy road that had some twists and turns. But ultimately, I don't know if there's any other way that it could be, right? My father made his choice of who he thought would be the most appropriate to take over the responsibility of managing the organization. And I think also I dealt with a lot of maybe what people would call imposter syndrome, which is saying, you know, I'm so young, I don't have all this experience, I hadn't worked outside of pharma at other organizations. Am I good enough? Do I have what it takes to do this? And so there was a lot of self-doubt. There was a lot of questioning of whether or not I could really do it.
Let's talk about Seaford. Who is Seaford? Could you tell us about it?
So Seaford is a Canadian pharmaceutical company that produces a range of products. We are, our products are available coast to coast. We have a hospital division of products as well as a pharmacy division. We have products that are behind the counter as well as BTC. And there are in a variety of therapeutic areas. Primarily, they are niche products. We have a nationwide sales force that promotes products to specialist physicians and family physicians, as well as select pharmacies. We've been in operation since 91, so over 32 years, and we contract out our manufacturing. We work with partners across the globe, as well as locally for our manufacturing. But aside from that, all of the other functions are performed in-house. So from regulatory approvals to marketing and to sales. So we've really focused on developing our sales team over the years, and that's something that we're really, really proud of, developing relationships with key opinion leaders and specialists in specific therapeutic areas for the products that we promote. And we've promoted products, Jim, in different therapeutic areas over time. So our portfolio right now is more heavily focused towards dermatology and urology and nephrology with a significant component for the family physician. But we have previous experience with products that are in different therapeutic areas, including cardiology and gastroenterology. That's my elevator spiel.
Well done. It's great to be talking to a Canadian-bred, Canadian-based pharmaceutical company because there aren't many.
No, you're right. And you're right.
It probably leads into a conversation about, poking at the life sciences sector in Canada at the moment. Are we, how do I put this? What direction do you see the industry at the moment? Like, is the bathtub filling or is it draining? Are we on the right path? What are your thoughts?
So I think post-COVID, there's been more political will to focus on incubating and supporting the Canadian pharmaceutical sector. It was obvious to everyone that we were caught unprepared for that pandemic. And it turned out that we really didn't have the internal infrastructure to support what was required to keep our population safe. And so it seems that there has been a shift, which I think is really important. And it's a drum that Seaford has been beating for many, many years. So I'm positive, I'm optimistic. I do think the flip side, however, is we do have some challenges. Health Canada, I would say, does pose a significant challenge where they do an excellent job of keep making sure that products that are available to Canadians are safe. And that's very, very important. I also think, though, that there needs to be a mindset, or it would be very helpful for there to be a mindset about how long does it take for applications at Health Canada to get processed? Because these are certain things that preclude or prevent Canada from being competitive in the international landscape. Yeah. So in some jurisdictions that are as heavily regulated and still have a high standard, it can be easier or faster to get products approved and into the market, into the hands of Canadians who need them for life-saving or life-altering or enhancing solutions. So that's where I see. Like, in certain areas, I see that there's more openness. There are more incubators to support growth of, say, like startup pharmaceutical companies, which is really good. But then when it comes to the regulation side and the regulatory side, I think that there is some real room for improvement. to understand what the forces of business are, with the goal, and I'm saying not the goal just to make more profit. I'm talking about the goal of getting more medicinal treatments or healthcare options into the hands of Canadians.
You and your family have created a foundation at Seaford, and I'd appreciate you telling our listeners about it.
Sure. So the Seaford Foundation is focused on providing support to the community at large. And we've chosen to start by going back to our roots. So there's a pediatric clinic in Jamaica, in Kingston, Jamaica, that we've supported. And it has been such an incredibly heartwarming experience to visit, which I did back May of 2023 at the clinic, to see how it's really been impacted by COVID. But the whole focus is really about providing support however we can to the community and leveraging any of the resources that we have available. So we've provided some financial support, but it's also sometimes when there have been natural disasters that have happened in the Caribbean, we've been able to provide medications or other donations wherever we have. So it's something that we've started on a relatively small scale, but where we recognize that no one is where they are or has come to be where they are on their own. And so we've stood on the backs of, you know, generations of others that have sacrificed. And it's an obligation that we see that we have to fulfill to do what we can when we can.
Thank you for that. And you're also involved with an organization called Black North and the Black Opportunity Fund, which I understand was founded in 2020 following the death of George Floyd.
Sure. And that was something that was important to me as well, further to, you know, to the topic that we were talking about. So my involvement has kind of changed depending on accessibility, but those are two organizations that I see as groundbreaking and I see as extremely important, which is providing support to the Black community, which is something we've talked about a lot, which is what is that community? It's such a varied diaspora, right? Individuals from African descent, from American descent, from Caribbean descent, sometimes just painted with one brush, but really different languages, you know, different cultures, different religions and so forth. Sometimes we'll have a shared experience, but we'll have very differences in and among us in the community. And so I think that those are two organizations that have done an excellent job of trying to address the issues from within, from a very, very professional perspective. And so I'm supportive of those organizations and their mandates.
Well, good for you. I'm going to pivot a bit here. And I'm wondering if there's ever been a moment where you thought, I don't know if we're going to recover from this. Like, what has been your biggest challenge and how did you overcome it?
Wow. So we've had lots of organizational challenges. I'm trying to sift through a few of them to see what would. So there have been some internal family challenges, right? Where there have been some, you know, bumpy roads. And one thing that's always been important to me, Jim, is I never wanted to sacrifice the family for the business. And while we say family business, I always wanted there to be the family first. And so that can be challenging. I mean, I don't know if you have the experience or you could think, what would that be like working with your siblings, working with your parents? You know, these are people who sometimes know what you're going to say before you even say it. Right.
Yeah.
And so there can be challenges invariably with, you know, personalities, but at the same time you go home and you have Thanksgiving dinner with these people. Right. So that has really presented some challenges over the years, and we're in a place, and it's been this way for a number of years, where we've sorted those out, and it will be interesting to see, say, for the next generation what that looks like, and that we've put in place certain structures to make things more straightforward. Because it's kind of like when you know when you're growing something, it's sometimes there isn't a structure that is obvious, and you have to make one that makes sense for the players that you have, the people that you have, and the resources that you have. So I'd say family, also limited resources. So, you know, Seaford, we compete against the big fishes, right? The ones right. that I don't know if I'd call them sharks. I might say that they're big whales, right? But just resource allocation. And so that has forced us to have to think much more creatively, to be much more nimble, and to adapt, right? Because I don't have the large resources. But the flip side, what I would also say is I've been able to leverage our size to our benefit, right? That I can make decisions, relatively speaking, and I'm using this term relatively, on a dime if I need to. I don't need to report to global, right? If we want to decide to take on a new partner or a product line, or to enter another market or whatnot. So I think often it's been about trying to focus on what our strengths are and to neutralize our weaknesses.
Huh. I'd like to take that question and turn it around. What's been your biggest win, and what did you learn from it?
So I'd say one of our biggest wins, Jim, is being, and I know this phrase gets overused, but I can't think of another one, so I'm just going to say it. So being our authentic selves, right? So many people that would come to be part of Seaford's employ, obviously they would have looked at other pharmaceutical companies and would compare. And for the longest time, especially after I had come out of my MBA, my goal was to make Seaford just like another large pharmaceutical company. And I came to a point where I thought, you know what, that is not who we are. And that is not a bad thing. That we are who we are, and we're what we are, and we have an exhaustive list of assets. And I think it was part of a process just to kind of, I don't know, like look back and realize that what I saw as deficiencies were actually just part of our own characteristics, right? So just because you're small or smaller, does that mean it's a bad thing? No. So we really spent a lot of time, Jim, focusing on our company culture and having that high touch, so that if you do come to Seaford, okay, you know, no, we don't have 40,000 employees, but you're literally welcomed into the family. You're literally part of a smaller team here that you can have access to the president as, you know, open door, that if you have an idea, it can be shared and it can be implemented. That if there is a gap in your training or an opportunity that you might want to explore, that you have the opportunity to do that, to be part of launch teams, to be part of new projects that are happening all the time. And so that probably was my biggest learning, which is to just change that mindset, right? And to realize that who we are and our way of doing things doesn't have to just be about trying to be someone else, but in our own right, and that's the authentic piece, in our own right, that we can be incredible and we can be formidable and we can be a choice, a positive choice for where people want to be. And so that was a real mind shift for us.
Wow. Yeah, elephants herd with elephants and antelope herd with antelope.
There you go.
We hope you like what we're doing, and if you do, we have a favor to ask. Please tell your friends about us. We would greatly appreciate you promoting us on social with the hashtags NGBI, NGBI Summit, NGBIdeas, and NGBI Lab. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it. Let's get back to today's show. I read that you brought your kids to work and you had them clock in and clock out.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, different perhaps from how when my dad had Seaford and I was in high school and kind of didn't really pay attention to it, for my kids, Seaford is very much real, you know, to them. And I really want them to be engaged right from the beginning. And so they come here at the summertime. And so initially it was, okay, just come and kind of hang out. And then it was, oh, okay, maybe you could do something. And then they would get a little bit of pocket money. And so that was kind of one step. And then another step was, okay, if you're going to get the money, you actually have to work for it. You have to do something. And then maybe that was the, was it the smart side or the tricky side where they realized that they could just kind of pretend to do stuff. So I said, no, you need to fully clock in, clock out. You got to write your start time. You got to write your end time. And you're only going to get paid for the work that you do. So I don't know. I figured it's, is that too harsh of me?
Or, not at all. Or no, I think that's a great lesson. Good for you.
right?
Now, 2021 marked the 30th anniversary of the company, and that was, of course, in the midst of the pandemic. And I'm wondering what that time was like for you and your team. Did you have to pivot to survive, or was it something that helped your business?
Wow. So it's mixed, right? And I think a lot of people, I remember them saying to me, oh, you're in pharmaceuticals, so you're fine, right? Like during the pandemic, anything healthcare related, you're fine. Well, that wasn't exactly the case, because it really depends on like your product mix. And within your product mix, what specific indications or diseases do your products treat? And some of them might be more lifestyle related, some of them not. For us, it was really mixed, because for some products, they continued, the demand continued for them independent of the impact of the pandemic. Others, because there were a reduction in the number of elective procedures at the hospital level, and so some of our products are reliant upon diagnostics and procedures occurring, that there was an impact as well. So from our perspective, it was mixed, right? We did pivot, which was really interesting for us, to working from home. So we maintained our warehouse and the office here, but then, you know, our sales staff, they were all working from home, which that was an interesting process, just like many other companies. And then most of our office staff, they were working from home during the pandemic. So that was really interesting. Many companies, we were already on or using the Microsoft Teams platform. So in terms of transitioning, like, that didn't require, from a technological perspective or an IT perspective, it didn't require much. But then for us to learn, okay, what it meant to really lean into the technology, because we had only used things like Teams and whatnot sparingly. And then, of course, like everybody else, we kind of really had to lean in. And so what I learned is that we were able to do a lot of things effectively at home. But there was that high touch and that piece of that Seaford sauce, if you will, you know, that ultimately I thought was missing. So when we had the opportunity to bring people back, I did that as much as I could, or as much as I thought was reasonable.
Good for you. You know, you are the second leader of a life sciences company we've had on this show as a guest, and who does not have a science background. Brigitte Nollet of Roche Canada Pharma is the other. And I'm wondering if your lack of bench experience has helped you be a better leader in this field.
I wonder that too. I mean, because, you know, it was a choice, right? Do I lean in on the business side? Do I lean in on the science side? Yeah. Right.
There's no wrong answer.
No, yeah. I know. Like, I played to my strengths. Right. Yeah. And so, I guess I could give myself a selling job here, where I think, you know, it has, because at the end of the day, the numbers have to make sense. Right. Yeah. Regardless of what, you know, what the idea is. And I've always been very conscious, or made an effort as much as I could, Jim, to be aware of what my deficiencies are, what my blind spots are, so that I could backfill those to make myself a more effective leader. I'm humbled every single day about how much I don't know. And one thing that I love about being in this industry is the opportunity to learn constantly every single day. And one thing that I don't even have to try to do, but naturally, I'm curious. And I think humility and curiosity have helped me to be a more effective leader, to not just make assumptions and to kind of gloss over things. The other thing that I feel is, regardless of whatever it is that we're selling, it's about people, right, Jim? Yeah. It's about people, right? It's people. Yeah. Who influence, it's people who make decisions, it's people who make that choice to do or to not do, whether they're motivated, you know, or not. And I think it's really important to forge connections and to make an effort to understand motivations behind, you know, people's decisions or their posture, or like however it is that they're presenting themselves. Because ultimately, whatever it is that we're doing, whether it is with a key accounts manager, you know, or a reviewer, you know, at Health Canada or whomever, at the end of the day, like, we're all people. And I think that's really important to learn and to understand, and to work with.
We're just down to a few questions, and I really appreciate your patience. This is a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying speaking with you. This next question is for the younger listeners of our podcast, and I wonder if there's been any moments in your personal life that have changed the way you work or live.
Becoming a mom, that's for sure. A mom of three was a game changer. That completely changed the way that I work and live, for sure.
Wow.
So I would liken it to, you know, some of my learning opportunities when I learned from my undergrad. Okay, how did I have to shift in order to become more effective? I couldn't just apply the same approach that I was using, right? And so what could take me 8 hours to do before kids, I might only have 2 hours to do, right? Because I have other responsibilities. And so I've really focused on prioritizing, differentiating between what is important versus what is urgent, understanding how to become a better delegator, realizing that I cannot do it all on my own, and taking a step back, Jim, and really understanding what are the true priorities. So I'm type A, and I love lists, and I love crossing things off. And I've been guilty of sometimes putting something on a list just so that I can cross it off. So there's that nerdy side of me. So when it comes to something like email, my tendency is to, like, I want to go through every single email, every single one. But then I realize, okay, if I have limited time, I cannot do that. I can't. So I've had to focus and prioritize. Okay, so what are the subjects that I need to, from an email perspective, to look at, right? Who are the people that I need to address? What are the things that are the most important to my business that someone else can't do, that I have to do? And so looking at things from a different lens has just been a game changer for me. And that's because I've just had more to juggle, right? So three kids, they're all in competitive hockey. Like, it's insane. We have a crazy schedule. How are we going to get all of this done? And it doesn't just mean that I sleep less. It means I have to work more effectively, work smarter, right? And so that's probably one of the biggest learnings that I've had.
Thank you for that. Is there something you hope to achieve that you have not yet been able to reach?
So one thing that we've been working on is clinical trials. And so my father has been focusing a lot in product development. So an incredible mountain for us to climb, but an incredible achievement would be taking a concept just from an idea to going through the entire clinical trial process all the way through to having a product available on the shelf would be an incredible achievement. So that's something that we're currently working on, and that would be a great milestone for us to achieve.
Wow, I look forward to announcements. That's exciting. Personal note, do you have anything on your bucket list that you're going to cross off this year?
So I have a goal. I would love to go back to South Africa. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, Jim, but my bucket list item is definitely to go back and complete that trip that I had planned from 20 years ago. So I look forward to it.
Book the ticket. This might be a tough question, but is there any advice you would give to students who are thinking about pursuing a career as an entrepreneur in the Canadian life sciences sector?
I think it's very important to network, and it can be challenging. And I remember even when I was doing my MBA, people would say, oh, network. And you don't even know sometimes, what are you networking for? Because you're kind of networking for opportunities that will happen in the future that you don't ultimately know. But I think it's very, very important, whatever it is that you choose to do, especially in Canada in life sciences, because it's kind of a relatively small industry, relatively small, yep. That once you have an opportunity to work with and meet a number of people and to create a good reputation for yourself, invariably that can translate to better opportunities in the future. So I think networking is really important.
Absolutely. One of our previous guests in 2023, Ella Corrett-Smith from Verica Biotech in Ottawa, talked about networking and turned, I think, the traditional mindset about networking on its head when she explains networking isn't about what other people can do for you. It's what you can do for them. And sure. That's what people remember. And again, for any students who are listening who have not listened to her podcast, I would strongly recommend that they do. She's just got so much great advice, as you've been offering today. We end every one of these interviews with the same question, and we're there. And that question is, what is the next great big idea on your horizon?
So the next great big idea on my horizon is really to take Seaford to the next level with accelerated growth. And it is launching new products. So that comes, it's a bit of a secret, so I can't just let it out, right? But we have a number of opportunities that we're actively working on that involve launches in different therapeutic areas that we haven't engaged in the past. So there's some risk for that, but with risk comes reward. So it's product launches that we're working on.
Fabulous. Well, again, I look forward to future announcements. This has been so much fun. Thank you for joining us today. It's been great learning about Seaford and hearing about your path and what you've got planned for the future.
Thank you for your time, Jim. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
That was Tamara Seals, president of Seaford Pharmaceuticals, which is one of the very few homegrown pharmaceutical companies headquartered in Canada. If you'd like to learn more, please go to Seaford, that's Seaford.ca. You can also follow Tamara and her team on social at Seaford Pharmaceuticals. This week's episode was researched by Daniela Ricchezza. If you'd like to follow us on social, we are at NGB Ideas and at NGB Lab. You can also follow our day job team at Lab Occupier. And if you'd like to contact me, please send me an email. My address is jwilson@leonard, that's LENNARD.com. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.